Hakan Kalender.
Mazlumlara zulmeden bütün zorbaların hakkından geliyor.
Ottoman Army Maker Band, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Such bands would accompany Ottoman Empire armies on their conquest throughout the Middle East and through the Balkans into Europe. And that's introducing us then to another episode here of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where we like to look at issues of the day for conservatives and others on this weekly blog talk radio show every Friday. And we are listening to that music because we're going to talk today with Ned May, the man behind the website Gates of Vienna, named after the 1683 Siege of Vienna, which was finally broken by a Turkish Ottoman Empire army, which was finally broken by the army led by the Polish King Sobieski III on September 11th plus one, you might say, September 12th. Ending the siege and defeating the Ottomans and stopping the advance, the high watermark of the Ottoman Empire in its advance through Europe, through the Balkans. So we want to talk with Ned May with now this recent spate of jihadist attacks across Europe and France and Austria in particular, and how Europe is reacting to these attacks and this modern continuation, you might say, of jihadist influence and attacks upon Europe and the West. Well, Ned May, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Well, first describe yourself and your background and the website, Gates of Vienna, and how this got started.
Well, my background is not actually in this kind of stuff. My background was in math and computers and art, but got into blogging in 2004, set up Gates of Vienna for my wife, who was grieving the death of her daughter, and we thought that it would help her to have a passion that she could write about online. And we were both interested in Islam after 9/11, and it grew from there, and then she died last year, but I'm continuing it, and it's been mostly my operation for the last 8 or 10 years anyway. I first encountered the problem of Islam when I read Among the Believers by V.S. Naipaul back in 1981 when it first came out. He made it without coming out and saying as much. He made it his writing about Iran and Pakistan and Indonesia and other Islamic countries made it clear that there was no way, there is no way for Islam to coexist with non-Islam, and that it is part of the Islamic scripture itself that requires that jihad be fought until the entire world becomes Islamic. And I remember saying to my wife back then, you know, this, so Islam and the West are going to come into conflict with each other sometime in the next 30 years or so. And that's what happened. And there's still a lot of people, a lot of political leaders that don't understand that Islam, by its very nature, cannot coexist with non-Islam. Non-Islam must become Islam. We are Dar al-Harb, and we must be fought until we become Dar al-Islam.
Well, yes, Naipaul, yes, he had two excellent books, both of which I've read. First, Among the Believers, as you mentioned, and then he had a sequel to that. The first one was written in 1979 or shortly thereafter, right after the Iranian Revolution that brought the Islamic Republic to power in Iran. V.S. Naipaul toured, as you indicated, the countries of Iran and Pakistan and Indonesia and Malaysia, these four non-Arabic countries where Islam had been brought from the outside as a conquering faith. And then he had his second book, Beyond Belief, about 4 years later in 1983, where he revisited the same countries. And I would highly recommend both books from V.S. Naipaul, the noted, the Nobel Prize winning writer from the West Indies, from Trinidad and Tobago, from a West Indian background, Indian background himself, from the Indians who were brought there from the South Asian subcontinent to the West Indies to work in the various plantations there. It's two excellent books on Islam. Looking at it today, now in these recent months, we've had a spate of jihadist attacks in France and Austria. In particular, there was the October 16th beheading of a French school teacher, a history geography school teacher for high school, Samuel Pepe, in a Paris suburb. And then shortly thereafter, on October 29th, there was then a slashing attack at a cathedral in Nice, France, where three people were killed in this cathedral there. And then on November 4th, or November 2nd, I believe it was, there was then an attack in Vienna by an individual. He was actually, he had Austrian and North Macedonian dual citizenship, a Muslim individual, and apparently, I guess, had sworn allegiance to the Islamic State and went on a shooting spree near Vienna's main synagogue, as well as an area I'm familiar with, having visited Vienna, called the Bermuda Triangle, which is an area of various bars together, and people were there in this last night before Vienna was going to go through Austria was going to go through a new nationwide COVID-19 lockdown, so people were having their last drink, their last night out. So there have been these various attacks here. How has the public in France and Austria and throughout Europe responded to these attacks? Is there a shift in European opinion on issues involving Islam in general and jihadist attacks in particular?
It's hard to say for sure. Public opinion in Austria has been more anti-Islam than most places for a while, but it doesn't necessarily affect public policy there. Austria has peculiar problems because Bosnia was part of the Austrian Empire, and which meant they had Muslims, and they had to accommodate Islam, and there was 1912 law in Austria that codified the place that Islam has in the, you know, as a state-recognized religion. And the Islam law was revised recently, a few years ago, and they did not improve the situation with that. Basically, they've got a situation where the state has to allow Muslims to have their own education the way they want it. And even though that's not officially what the law means, that's what it has meant in practice based on the way they divided up the power with the Islamic Association. And, oh, by the way, that attack in Vienna on November 2nd, the intended target, it came out later, the intended target wasn't the synagogue. It was a meeting of Catholic youth group in a church close by to where the attack took place. And they couldn't get in. The guy couldn't get in, so he just was shooting people in the street instead until he was shot dead.
Yeah, and indeed killed four people, right.
Yeah. Oh. In France, things are going so fast and hard in France, I can't keep track anymore. Back when I first started doing this, every attack that came along, you know, I'd cover it, whether it was by getting something translated or going by English language reports, whatever, I'd cover it. And can't cover them anymore. They happen every day. If you go to the French website F de Souche and put it through Google Translate, you can see them every day. Just and they're a lot of them are of the basic youth crime type rather than jihad. You know, they're immigrant youth. Committing all these nasty crimes with the usual stuff, you know, violent robbery, rape, and everything. But then there are the Allahu Akbar crimes in there, too, with, you know, people pulling knives on police or on pedestrians or whatever. They happen all the time. It is nonstop now. If you pay attention to what's going on in the French media, there's even some discussion about it. And of course, Emmanuel Macron has been to pretend like he's more anti-jihad because he's facing Marine Le Pen as right now, if the election were held right now for president, she would win. But he's got, what, a year and something to prepare against it, and they've got their deep state there just like we do, and I'm sure they can keep her down again. They kept her down last time, but right now she's really popular in the polls, so Macron is moving in the direction of pretending to be against Islam, but he's also very accommodating of Islam in public institutions. He wants the training of imams to become a French government function, which is basically institutionalizing a version of Islam in the French government, which, you know, they are a secular state, so that's going to be a remarkable sleight of hand to be able to do that. But the whole point of France is it's a secular state, right? But the training of imams is controlled by, I can't remember if it's Turkey or Saudi Arabia or maybe both, and that's what the new rule is intended to eliminate. The French Muslim Association has to come up with a system whereby Muslims will be trained and approved in France with no foreign imports, no foreign money behind it. But to my mind, that's just institutionalizing Islam within the French state.
Well, I've heard talk of that around Europe and other countries in Europe of training imams domestically and worries of, you know, we don't want Turkey, we don't want Saudi Arabia, and the people we get from there are just really you know, really radical, really just doctrinaire, orthodox. We want someone more, you know, moderate, reflective, and so forth. Has any other European country instituted any such domestic training of imams?
They're working on it. I can't remember if they've come all the way to it, but in Britain, well, Islam is almost the state religion in Britain now. But whether they have a domestic training of imams mandated, I don't know. Germany is arguing about it. They have their Islamic organization that's controlled by Turkey. Turkey is the main influence in Germany, and the German government is very pro-Turkish and has been for more than a century. And there is an argument now about whether the Turks should be allowed to directly control so much about Islam in Germany, because the Turks in Germany vote in Turkish elections, and that the Erdogan is considered, they consider Erdogan their leader, and Angela Merkel is just somebody they have to live with, but they're led by Turkey. But whether it's going to go anywhere, I don't know. Denmark does better than most. Denmark has just instituted a very controversial new rule about how statistics on crime are gathered. There's a fight over it with the usual cries of racism, that they are separating out, it's called MENAPT, Middle East, North Africa, Pakistan, and Turkey. They are gathering statistics on crime separately for those countries because so much more crime is committed by immigrants from those countries. They don't have problems with immigrants from Vietnam or China or Finland. You know, they have problems with the Middle Eastern immigrants. And just wanting to collect statistics on it causes huge trouble. I watched a video the other day of Bashi Qureshi arguing with a Danish woman about it being racism to collect statistics that way. But Denmark's willing to do it. In France, it's against the law to collect statistics based on religion or race. That's why you can't say the Muslim population of France is such and such a percent, because it's been 15 or 20 years since the French have allowed the collecting of statistics. Anything that you, if you want to determine the number of Muslims in France, you have to deduce it from various things. Some people say 10%, 12%. I think it's probably over 15% right by now, which means they're past the tipping point. Once a country passes 15%, it becomes Muslim. There's no going back. And it's just a matter of how the power is going to be divided up and when the official takeover is going to be. It's only a matter of time that French will become Islamic or be partitioned, one or the other.
Well, how is now in your work, do you have a lot of sources you rely upon for news in Europe? Do you have contacts in France or Germany and Austria with whom you communicate to follow these political developments?
Yes, there's it's a loose network, and a lot of people send me stuff. But Vlad Tepes, he does the videos, and between the two of us, we have a big collection of people who are willing to translate. And right now, we have a plenty of German translators, which is why we put out so much news from Germany and Austria. Just got a new French translator the other day, so maybe we'll get more on France than we've been having. We had two clips from Eric Zemmour the other day, but we communicate on Skype. That's where it comes in real time. People in different time zones, the Central Europe is 6 hours ahead of us, so Miss Piggy is on Skype talking to us in the middle of the night, our time, but it's early in the morning, her time, telling us what's happening in Germany that day. And then she's around for a good part of the day, and then she's gone in the evening. It's just me and Vlad. But we get the reports coming in from Germany and Austria, from those. And then Gary Faust has a gift for languages. He does Italian, Spanish, sometimes French, Dutch, Swedish, Italian he can, and Spanish he can understand spoken. The other languages he's only good on the written. So we get a lot of information through him. And there's his Swedish contacts have produced a group that does Scandinavian translations. And in Scandinavia, Denmark and Sweden are as different as night and day. Denmark is, they're more realistic about things than they are even in this country, I think, because that what they just did, we'd have a good big fight about that if we tried to do that in this country, and I'm not sure we'd do as well as Denmark. But Sweden is like France. There's no statistics on ethnicity. You have to deduce them, and there are laws against doing certain things, and you can get arrested for, I'm not sure exactly what you can get arrested for. You get arrested for whatever they feel like arresting you for, but Denmark is much more reasonable than Sweden. But you can still get busted in Denmark for saying the wrong thing about Islam, because Lars Hedegaard he's been through trials twice, I think, for the things he said about Islam. So
yeah,
I forget what question you asked me that led me.
Well, no, it was very interesting. I was just asking about your sort of contact network in Europe. Gary Faust I've communicated with on Facebook. We know each other. We're Facebook friends there. Vlad Tepes, I've seen his name before. Where is he from?
He's in Ottawa.
Oh, I see. He's a Canadian. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Does he come from any particular European country or?
No, he's just doing the whole thing. And Hungary is the European country that's totally different. Hungary is, to my mind, it's a wonderful place. They've got the Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who is they're very fortunate that they have ethnic homogeneity there. There's just Hungarians, that their immigrant population isn't high enough to decide the elections like they are in Western Europe. And with the party that's in power now and has been in power for a while, it's very popular with a large majority. They are passing laws that protect the country from Islamization. And that's why George Soros is concentrating so hard on overthrowing Orban, because Hungary and Poland together are like this bulwark against immigration and Islamization in Europe. They're in the Czech Republic and Slovakia to a lesser extent, the Visegrad Four, but especially Hungary. Hungary is the most stalwart and the least compromised. Poland has been compromised by Western influence to some extent. The big cities have big cities in Hungary, the same is true there, but it's even worse in Poland. The big cities have progressive, multicultural-oriented mayors and stuff, and they have their own immigration policy. They become sanctuary cities just like the cities do here, you know. But Hungary is better off than the rest of them, and for that reason, people who are being driven out by a situation in Western Europe are trying to get into Hungary. Hungary doesn't just let anybody in. You have to bring a certain amount of capital with you, and a lot of Germans have ended up in Hungary. Ted Ekeroth moved there for a while, though I think he moved back, and his brother Kent from Sweden.
Interesting. Well, looking at, you mentioned Soros. I mean, looking at politics, in you talk about Macron in France. How has the European left responded to these issues involving Islam? For example, I mean, well, French Emmanuel Macron, of course, as you've noted, he's from the Socialist Party, the Social Democratic Party in France. And also, I recently heard German Green leaders have come out and said that, you know, they're expressing worries about political Islam, political Islamic doctrines and its effects on society. So how's the European left responding to all of this?
Yeah, well, you just said it, that political Islam, Islamist, it's the same as in this country, that nobody can bring themselves to look at the fact that nobody in the center or the left can bring themselves to look at the fact that Islam is the issue and not Islamism or political Islam or some other imaginary subdivision of Islam that's bad while other parts are good. The Macron is actually, he's a New World Order guy. He's a creature of the bankers. If you were watching when he was first brought to prominence, the party was put together and had the banking of the backing of the banks. That is, he's the leader that suits the bureaucratic structure of the European Union, which is in tune with the globalists. And so whatever he does, if he's going against Islam anyway, he's just tacking with the political winds of the time. Boris Johnson and Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz are all cut from a similar cloth. They're opportunists without principle who will do whatever is necessary to stay in power. And they're kind of the opposite of Viktor Orban in Hungary. But the left is not resistant to Islam. They are appalled by political Islam, and they want to combat that, but not Islam itself. More mosques, more immigrants, that's fine. We just have to make sure that the extremists don't take charge. And as we all know, that's a pipe dream. You let Muslims in, you're going to have the full range of Islamic behavior, which is, and when there aren't many of them, they're nice and they're pleasant, and you think this is good, and you don't realize what's going on in the background. And then the more of them there are, you get more demands, and then you get the nice ones saying, well, look, those extremists, we don't like them either. We will help you combat the extremists, and for that, you need to let more Muslims into the country, the nice ones like us, which is basically where we are in the USA right now. Because I don't know how close the Muslims are to having the swaying the vote at the margin like they do in Europe, but and definitely in places like Detroit, probably in New York too. Muslims must have a pretty commanding position because they vote as a block. You know, while the non-Muslims are divided up into their different factions, Muslims generally vote as a block. And whatever candidate gets their approval can well get elected because of that when there are enough of them. And that's why Britain is out of luck now, even if they have real elections, not the pretend one like we just had. Even if they have real elections, the Muslims will still sway the balance, and the party, whichever party it is, it doesn't matter, will either kowtow to the Muslims or they won't get in. That's why Boris Johnson, you'll notice, is not really fighting immigration or Islam at all. He's not even really fighting for Brexit, but that's another matter entirely.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's curious to me is, how does the role of Islam in Europe, do you see any connection between the role of Islamic influence in Europe, where like survey opinion polls, as you've indicated, show that most Europeans or many Europeans, either do not think that Islam is compatible with Western values, European values, or see dangers in it. For example, I was looking recently. There's a poll in 2019. There was a poll. Let me see if I can find it. That 38% of Britons agreed with the statement. There is a fundamental clash between Islam and the values of the society in my country. And then 46% of French people and 47% of Germans also agree with that statement. How does such feelings among Europeans, does that affect their relationship towards Israel? Does that mean that, for example, such Europeans, they have more understanding for Israel's position in the Middle East, dealing with various jihadist threats?
Well, that's a complex topic. Anti-Semitism in Europe is, there's a lot of variety. Like Italy and Denmark, in my experience, are the least anti-Semitic countries in Europe. And I don't want to get in a mudslinging match about the other ones, but they're, some of the other countries are very, and I'm not talking about the Muslims, I'm talking about the native Europeans, are virulently anti-Semitic on, not everybody, not even necessarily majority, but there's a large strain of virulent anti-Semitism in some European countries. And when you add Muslims to the mix, which is what you have in France, and you have a lot of Muslims, then definitely will tend to sway state policy. But state policy is tilted against Israel and in favor of the Arab states in Europe in general since the mid-1970s during the oil crisis when it wasn't the European Union then. It was probably still just the common market. But anyway, there was an agreement between the Europeans and the Arab countries that if the Arab states would guarantee an unimpeded flow of oil at an acceptable price, then Europe agreed to allow the immigration from the Middle East. And the Middle East needed that because they had a lot of surplus population. They especially needed to get rid of the political malcontents, which are what we call Islamists, so have them go off to Europe. And that's been going on for more than 40 years now. And it's all chronicled in one or another of yours books, by the way, probably in Eurabia. It may have the best account of all that. This is not a conspiracy. It's in the public record that all this stuff went on, that these agreements were made. And back then, of course, the European demographers could look at the birth rates and the trends and see that in 30 or 40 years, they wouldn't have enough of the younger generation to support their generous welfare system, which requires collecting taxes on working age people. And so it probably seemed like a good idea to have all those immigrants anyway, to have younger people coming in to work and pay the taxes. What they got, on the other hand, was people who don't who consume more government service than they can contribute taxes. And that's what they have now. But the process has been going on so long, it's so far advanced, that there's no going back anymore. And so they are importing them in, and this is not just Muslims, but mostly Muslims from Africa, at a record rate. The German NGOs are the most prominent expediters of the process of getting them from Africa into Europe. And the coronavirus hasn't slowed them down at all. While Everybody else is locked down and worried. The boats are still crossing the Mediterranean. And when the Italians try and keep them out, they go to France or go to Spain or to Greece. And they're coming overland through Turkey, and then they cross to the Greek islands. And Erdogan, of course, is facilitating the process. He wants as many of these to get into Europe as possible, because weakening and destabilizing Europe is part of his plan for renewing the Ottoman Empire. And he's moving the other direction, too, by the way. His little game in Azerbaijan shows that he's moving in both directions. I think I've wandered far afield from what you're about.
Bas Yor's Eurabia, of course, is a work I'm familiar with, and many others. And speaking of such influxes from the outside, you know, in Nice, then, in this attack on the cathedral where three people were killed in a knife attack, this jihadist, he was a refugee guy. He had recently come to France from the Italian island of Lampedusa. What has been the role, then, of such refugees or such people, immigrants, I guess, or economic immigrants, you might describe them in many cases, not necessarily refugees or fleeing anything, in such jihadist attacks? Has this been a common occurrence in recent years in France? And are Europeans then going to rethink their refugee and immigration policies accordingly?
Well, you would think they would. There's been a bunch of them. I believe the one that ran down the Christmas market in Germany a few years ago, I think he was another one, refugee. That sometimes it's ones that were born in France, though, and same in Britain. And it's the second generation is often more radical than the first. But sometimes it's the immigrants. It can be both, and a whole lot of actual Mujahideen were imported into Europe in 2015, the so-called Syrians. They had ISIS embedded in them. You know, there's a lot of them in Europe. And some people think that they're just sleeper cells waiting to be activated. But I don't know. There's not much public information on that. You get some of the attacks, you get these people who have sworn allegiance to the Islamic State. I think the one in Nice was Tunisian.
Yes, I believe so. That's right. Correct. Yeah, Tunisian, right.
He came from Tunisia. A relatively recent immigrant from Tunisia. And the earlier attack in Nice, was it Nice, where the few years ago where he ran down all those people on the promenade? I can't remember if he was an immigrant or not, but I hate to say it, but it doesn't really matter. It's second, third, fourth generation, it can come from anywhere in Islam. But the more of them you bring in, the more you're going to get. And since there's so many immigrants coming into Europe now, there are going to be more and more attacks by immigrants. The one in Sweden who ran down those people on the street several years ago, I think he might have been an immigrant, a refugee, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming from Central Asia. They aren't always from North Africa and the Middle East. A fair number of them come in from Central Asia, and there's the problem of the Chechens, of course. And they're not only Muslims, they're also hardened criminals, generally speaking. They're like the Albanians. They have these long-term criminal networks. The Chechens are among the most brutal criminal networks, though. And they're all through Europe now, the Chechens are.
Well, indeed, in the Samuel Fattah beheading in the Paris suburb just on October 16th, that was a Chechen individual
who was then shot dead
by police. And actually back home in Chechnya, it was reported that he, actually had a pretty sort of like a hero's funeral. I mean, he was really kind of celebrating.
He did, yes, he did. And Russian government has uses for things like that, just so long as it doesn't happen on Russian soil, you know. And where were the Where were the Boston Marathon bombers from?
They were Chechen, yeah.
They were Chechen, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they'd come in.
Chechnya is bad news. Whether they're jihadists or not, they're bad news because they are intensely criminal, and generally speaking. If you have a bunch of Chechens in your country, you're going to have violent criminal enterprises, and that's just the way they are.
Yeah, well, and the Chechens were also noted among the Islamic State fighters. They were noted as being some of the prime fighters, the most devoted, skilled, fanatical fighters in the Islamic State. They were a key group of foreign fighters. Speaking of Samuel Paté beheading, I found it interesting that after his beheading, you had in France, for example, in Paris, in the neighborhood where he was beheaded, or I guess it was on the City Hall building, they took these Charlie Hebdo cartoons that Samuel Paté had shown to his school kids 11 days before on October 5th, and they projected them on a building with this light image, so just publicly showing them, sort of making a statement of, we're not going to back down on issues of free speech. We're going to show these cartoons, without apology. We're not going to be intimidated. Has there been any change on issues involving free speech in Islam following this beheading? Is there any sort of hardening among European opinion that, we simply have to stand up to these attacks and we have to allow people to say what they want, to criticize Islam as they wish?
I don't know if there's been any change or not. What you're talking about has gained more prominence because of that. But the beheading of Paté, you have to remember there's a class element in all this. When the horrible crimes are mostly occurring in areas or with victims that are not from the educated middle class, they don't get that kind of attention. But when Charlie Hebdo, it was the educated middle class, and Paté even more so because he was a teacher, that gained the attention of the French middle class. And so at least for right now, you've got a strong sentiment. But when I think back to, 10, 15 years ago, when they might have had a chance of dealing with the problem, they were busy prosecuting people. Marine Le Pen's been prosecuted. Brigitte Bardot was prosecuted for saying things. And so now they quit prosecuting people, but they've got too many Muslims to deal with. At this point, it doesn't matter whether the French public becomes adamant about free speech. That there are too many Muslims in the country. They are going to be overwhelmed. They are being overwhelmed. The security services, the police are currently being overwhelmed by it. And there is not enough manpower to deal with all the violent Islamic crime that's occurring in France. And of course, in Britain, police services are so thoroughly Islamized that, you probably know about the grooming gangs and all that. Basically, Muslims can act with impunity in a lot of things in Britain as long as they don't get too outrageous, whereas regular citizens, non-Muslim citizens, will be heavily fined for littering on the street and stuff like that. But the big thing that's going on in Europe now is the coronavirus, the COVID-19. Things are bad in this country, especially in California and Michigan. And I've got a midnight to 5 a.m. curfew on me here in Virginia. But in Europe, it's worse. The totalitarianism has just come right out, and that's what is currently driving issues, especially in Germany, is the coronavirus rules and lockdowns, and naturally the immigrants don't get prosecuted or it's not enforced against immigrants like it is against the natives. When you have a lot of immigrants demonstrating, there's nobody busting them for not social distancing, you know. But some of the strongest resistance is in Germany, it seems kind of surprising because the Germans are known for their being compliant and obedient to authority. But it looks like Germany is coming close to a tipping point. They have bigger demonstrations against the coronavirus restrictions in Germany than anywhere else in Europe, massive demonstrations. And they have more public opinion and public writings of scientists and doctors and stuff are much more openly critical of the coronavirus policies than in most countries. So Germany is the place to keep an eye on for the evolution of the coronavirus. The intersection of the coronavirus stuff and the immigration stuff is what's accelerating the situation so fast now. It's hard to keep track of all the changes that are going on. But one thing I do note is that I can't travel to Europe, but the immigrants can travel across the Mediterranean and be brought into Europe with no problem. The immigration remains unabated across the Mediterranean, legal or not. They're coming in.
Well, looking at one thing, I guess you speak of. Thinking of these issues involving Islam in Europe, you say that sort of 15% is a tipping point in a population, that's when Islam becomes really dominant. But is it also true, like I remember seeing one Pew poll of Muslims in the United States, it was found that something like in a generation, some 23% of Muslims or people from Muslim background will respond by saying that they no longer identify as Muslim or they no longer practice the faith. How does that play out in Europe in particular? Is there a significant portion of Muslims in European countries, through the generations as they grow up in Europe, that they no longer really identify with the faith? They just become more secular or more and sort of move away from any kind of any notions of Sharia or anything like that?
Well, look at it this way. I know an Iranian guy that fits in this category. He came to this country before the revolution, and he's a secular guy. Came with his wife, raised kids here, and you know he's not identifying as Muslim because he sent his kids to a Christian school. No Muslim who identifies as a Muslim and considers Islam important would ever send his kids to a Christian school. First of all, he's Iranian, and there was a lot of secular culture in Iran. And secondly, he didn't have this network he was moving into that required him to stay Islamic, which is usually the case. If you're an immigrant to a European country, you're not just moving into a European country. You're moving into subculture of whatever the Islam from whatever country you're coming from. So when those early Pakistanis came to Britain, the first few thousand of them back in the 60s, they were, a lot of them were probably glad to get out of Pakistan and all that crap they had to endure there. They became pretty secular. But Islam was established in the British areas where they went to, and there were mosques, and secular Muslims, they associated themselves with the mosques, and their children went to the mosque. And the second generation grew up, and they were, they went to the mosque, and some of them that were inclined that way, they heard these things in the mosque about what Islam really was and what the rules were, and that's how they became radicalized. And when the 7/7 bombers blew up in the underground in London, their parents couldn't understand how they ended up like that. You know, they the parents weren't like that. They came to Britain. They were glad to be shed of most of that baggage. They just kept their connections with the Islamic culture. And that's enough. As long as the mosques exist, as long as, and if you have enough Muslims in an area, there will be a mosque, or they're not Muslims, and they will insist on mosques, and they will build more mosques. And every mosque is a center of indoctrination, and as they become, Muslims become more numerous, mosques are also armories and places where strategic planning takes place for what is to be done against the infidels. When there are enough Muslims in the country, that's what will happen. And the tipping point, when I say the tipping point is 15%, that's kind of a generalization based on experience with countries that Islamize. And I guess if you do the statistics on it, that's how North Africa was conquered. It wasn't conquered by a single wave of armies and soldiers. It was conquered by groups moving into different areas, becoming numerous enough, not being aggressive, but being numerous enough to start affecting things. And then you can have alliances between, you know, Muslim city-state and an adjacent Christian city-state against another Christian city-state. And the Muslims kept the end goal in mind, which is to have all of the world Islamic. And that's how they conquered as much of Spain as they did. It was one, the Muslim invaders would make alliances with one Spanish political entity, kingdom or princedom or whatever they were, against the others. And they, until they'd eventually conquered all of Spain but Asturias, that's the way they conquer. And that's what they, that's their political operating method, the divide and conquer. You know, the Venetians were not willing to help defend Constantinople from the Ottomans. They had business relations with the Ottoman Empire. It was not in their interest to protect the Constantinople. And or when the Turks were, the last siege of Vienna in 1683, the French king was not willing to support, even though the Pope told him to, not willing to support the Christians. He had an interest in the breakup of the Austrian Empire. In fact, he did grab some of the Rhineland-Palatinate states, I believe, at the time. It was in his interest that the Turks go ahead and take Vienna. That's the way Islam conquers. They turn us against ourselves. And you can see that wherever they've gone, and it will happen here eventually if we continue to let them in, and which, as far as I know, only Donald Trump has ever tried to change that trend.
Well, looking at France again, one of the responses that the government under Macron has had, and his interior minister, if I'm saying his name right, Gerald Darmanin, who actually one of his grandfather was apparently a man of Muslim background from Algeria, so that's interesting. But he's, you know, he's along with the Macron government, he's taking a hard line. Is they closed down this group called the Collectif contre l'Islamophobie en France, or the Collective Against Islamophobia in France. Do you know anything about that organization? It was condemned as having links with the Muslim Brotherhood. Discuss with us that organization and its background and why Macron acted against it.
Well, Macron, I don't know anything about that organization, so I can't help you there. But Macron would act against it if it was in his interest to act against it, very temporary interest. And by the way, you mentioned, what was it, the interior minister having Muslim background? Boris Johnson's grandfather was, I think it's his grandfather, was Turkish. That is, he's
yeah, that's
Islamic
right.
background himself. But it's the same. Those three leaders, Macron, Johnson, and Kurz in Austria, they act in the interests of maintaining their power. they will be against Islam and Islamic things when it's in their interest to do so, and then they won't be when it's not. And in France, it can't be in your interest indefinitely to act against Islam because there are so many Muslims in France. Anything that Macron is doing right now is tacking. He's taking these actions with one eye on the presidential election in 2022, and he has to also consider how much public uprising he can withstand, because there are immense demonstrations in France these days and against various things. They're not having the coronavirus demonstrations so much, but they're having, what is that latest one? There's a series of demonstrations that have been going on for a few weeks in France. Darn, I'd have to go look it up now. I'm forgetting. But it's neither Islam nor the coronavirus. It's something else. And you remember the yellow vests. They were going on for quite a while. But his calculations have to be about how much public disorder his administration can withstand before his power base becomes unstable. So right now he's obviously considers it expedient to take actions that are at least superficially anti-Islamic, but at the same time he's groveling towards Muslims in other circumstances. You know, the Islam has always been a part of France. The same kind of stuff you hear in Germany. You know, Islam belongs to Germany. That when you have a large enough minority of them, you have to do those things. You have to go visit the mosques, and you have to go to say, how you know Islam is a peaceful religion and all that stuff, the George W. Bush type stuff about Islam. France, and when you look at the larger picture, France doesn't have a chance. It will either become an Islamic state or it will be partitioned. Those are the only two choices for it.
Well, what about, if you look at, United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, they're recognizing Israel. They're also doing things like changing their textbooks and instituting reforms like, in United Arab Emirates, it no longer matters whether you have sex outside of marriage or whatever. You see sort of this movement of these modernizing countries that have now become so integrated with the world that they're sort of moving away from these Islamic standards. Would that be evidence against that thesis that Muslim populations just sort of remain monolithic and they never just sort of secularize or liberalize or sort of respond to the modern world and modern society?
Well, I'm not an expert on what goes on in the Persian Gulf, but my intuition is that that's a very superficial occurrence at the highest levels and is expedient for them. You remember that the Islamic radicals come in when they come into play. They're against those governments that are doing those things. Those governments are blasphemers. So that was that way with the at 9/11 time. The Saudi Arabia. The authorities in Saudi Arabia are the enemy to the true believers. And I'm sure it's no different now and probably even more so. The more they promulgate laws like that, the more opposition they will have from below. I don't think the average citizen in the United Arab Emirates has become less Islamic because of that. I think that is part of the government policy for strategic reasons. And that's another Trump accomplishment, getting that to happen, by the way. It's amazing what he was able to do to get them to come to the table and do those things. But I don't think that changes the opinion about Islam at the ground level. As long as people really believe it, And as long as the books say what they say, then they will be in favor of jihad and slaying the infidel. It's in their scripture. As if they somehow became non-believers, secular in mass numbers, then it'd be different. But in order to do that, they have to pass through the stage when those who become non-believers, when they're caught, they're killed, right? They have to do so in secret. And those princes that are promulgating these new laws are insulated from that. They can afford the protection so that they don't get killed for doing that. But average people can't do that. And you do get killed if you go against what it says in the Quran. And you can expect to be killed. It happens. Well, look at Pakistan. It happens all the time in Pakistan.
Well, yeah, those
and
are
they
the
have,
dangers.
They have secular people in Pakistan, but they can't get any traction.
Right. Right. Oh, yeah, or just simply family ostracization or, you know, backlash or I'll say imprisonment under, like, apostasy or blasphemy laws or so forth. Yeah, there's a whole panoply of dangers and responses. Well, Ned May, I thank you for joining us here for this hour with another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host here, Andrew Harris. I hope our listeners will tune in next week for another interesting show where we examine issues of the day for conservatives and others. And Ned May from Gates of Vienna, I thank you very much for introducing your website to us and sharing with us your experience and your knowledge on these issues.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me on.
All right. Well, until another time for Conservative Casual Friday with Andrew Aaron. Thank you very much.